This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Graham Burnett, and I'm going to be Graham Burnett all evening, as opposed to my co-panelists here, who have agreed this evening, in various ways, to ventriloquize not just the general condition of the ball, although that may happen, but also some specific balls. So welcome to our roundtable tonight. I am a ball. And our aim in the next hour, unless this becomes before the 60-minute mark, a radical failure necessitating
entirely possible
the hook, or as we say in Spanish, gancho, get the hook. Unless we end up in that zone, for the next 60 minutes, we'll be attempting to think sport on the occasion of Cabinet's handsome sport issue from that essential but inexplicably, comma, often, overlooked perspective, the perspective of the ball itself. And so joining me to attempt that exercise are my esteemed colleagues and friends, Dominic Petman, Carlin Wing, Matt Friedman, and Simon Critchley. And I'm going to let them introduce themselves in turn in just a moment. But before we do that, to sort of get us in the mood of thinking the ball as central, thinking the ball's perspective, if you like, we thought we would launch with a really strange filmic discovery, which we have thanks to Dominic. This is about a minute-long clip from a sort of experimental cinematic short made by the Croatian Yugoslavian cinematographer Ivan Ladislav Galeta, who died in 2014. If there are some like serious hardcore avant-garde cinema people in the audience, they may have encountered this, but none of the rest of us had. It's called Water Pulu. And I'll just ask Sina, if he would, in the back, our perennial host for All Things Cabinet, to cue that up and run it for us. Supposed to do this. Don't panic. Okay, for those of you who are want the full experience, it's available on YouTube. It's the full match with that kind of exquisite Apollonian centering on the ball. And when we think ball perspective, I think it's probably right to think of that as the Apollonian version, since we can also probably conjure what it would be like to see from the ball's perspective, but that would be a considerably more disorienting and Dionysian perspective. And perhaps to tell us a little bit about that perspective, let me turn things over for introductions to our panelists, beginning with Dominic Petman. Dominic.
Thank you, Graham. This is a pleasure and an honor, but it's also a very painful experience for me because I'm going to be, this is the first time in public that I'm going to be reliving a very shameful, traumatic moment, which was the underarm delivery during a cricket match between Australia and England. I was the ball. And to explain to those of you who don't really understand cricket, which I almost assume is a majority of you, even though in the beginning of the game it was an underarm sport, as it evolved and when it became formalized in the 19th century, the overarm bowling action is one of the characteristic aspects. And so the standard ball, unlike baseball, bounces, hits the pitch, and goes past, oh well, goes towards the batsman. And this is the standard delivery. And in this, I don't know if I'll be able to actually watch, but we're going to show you the moment soon when this happened, when it was a very exciting match between Australia and New Zealand, the perfect match that everyone hopes for, where everything comes down to the last ball. New Zealand needed 6 runs to tie the match, and 6 runs is the maximum you can get in cricket off one hit. You have to hit the ball over the fence, so it doesn't happen very often in any game. And it's sort of like a Greek tragedy or something. The older brother was the captain of the Australian team, ordered his younger brother to bowl a technically legal ball, but one that nobody had ever seen in their lifetime, which was along the pitch, along the ground, so that it was impossible to score. So it was a very unsportsmanship decision, which nobody, the crowd was unhappy. Everyone was unhappy except the captain, who won the game technically. But he has never been able to live it down, and subsequently I haven't been able to live it down. I could never go out without somebody mentioning it. It became a big stigma, which is why I moved to the U.S. and changed my name to Dominic Petman. I went to the New School to do work on, as a way of kind of working through this. I knew I couldn't leave cricket forever because I love it. I'm a cricket ball after all. But to sort of atone for being a part of this shameful moment, the most shameful moment, arguably, in cricket, I'm doing a dissertation on, I'm actually working with Simon a little bit, he's helping me,
yes,
on the theoretical, philosophical aspects, but cricket as a colonial vector, that's my topic.
Are you going to be okay with us showing the clip?
I think so by now.
We're very lucky to have this important ball bowled in 1981 with us tonight, and I believe we have that queued up, and we'll see if it's... This is going to be the first time that...
Is there a spot down the front here if you want people to sit? There's four.
The front row.
Front row is empty. Come down if you wish.
This is about a minute-long clip in which you'll see some discussion and awkwardness as people realize that the ball is going to be rolled down the pitch to prevent the batsman from being able to hit a game-tying, a match-tying.
There was nothing I could do.
Nothing that Dominic could do about this. Go ahead and let's roll it.
One's only hope now is a 6 off the last ball for a tie.
long discussion. Well, it looks to me as if they're going to bowl underarm off the last ball. Rod Marsh is saying no, mate, but I'm sure he's going to bowl an underarm delivery on the last ball and bowl it along the ground and be sure that it has not been hit for six. The umpires have been told, the batsmen have been told, and this is possibly a little bit disappointing. Let's make sure it is an underarm, but I've got the feeling it's the ex-Victorian skipper. They're going to bowl an underarm. We haven't believed it.
Game.
That's a disappointing finish. Disappointed Brian affecting the crowd boom. And it's all over. After 50 overs, New Zealand 8 for 229.
One's only hope now.
Thank you. Yes, no more for sure. We wouldn't want to do that again. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us. Colin, talk to us.
Thank you all for being here. I am not as ignominious, is that word? Ball as Dominic, but I'm here to represent. Sina, can I have the first picture, please? I am a Wilson U.S. Open tennis ball that was diverted. I was on my way to the U.S. Open a couple of years back, and I was diverted to the USTA bounce testing facility in Westchester. And so, despite the fact that I am, like, you know, almost every other tennis ball today, made out of optic yellow felt on the outside, made for TV, I was denied my moment in the sun, and I've ended up after some testing as kind of a buffer to the bounce test machine in the USTA facility. What's interesting is from this position, probably unlike a lot of other tennis balls, I have had an opportunity to witness. I don't really know how to cycle through these. Maybe we can just continue. Yeah, this is my machine. Now you can see where I'm perched. And so I'm buffering the machine that tests the ball for bounce, that how high it will bounce back. To your left, you can see the machine that tests the deformation. And so I've had a kind of unique education in the standards and specifications and the immense amount of energy that goes into the production of true bounce, which for my game of tennis, of course, is the key. It is what is organized around. And so I just brought a few other images to show you guys of my home. This is what it looks like when some of the fellow travelers get tested. This is the deformation. It tests it from all four sides, maybe six, because top and bottom. And that's just a friend of mine.
Do you want to say a word about the color field?
Oh, yeah. I feel like I already referenced it in the optic yellow, but what's nice is I get this... This display is all of the different kinds of felts that are currently used for tennis balls. There's some arguments over whether what is called yellow is actually a kind of fluorescent green. It was in 1972 when the ITF, the International Tennis Federation, conducted a study kind of demonstrating that it was easier for viewers on television to follow the ball if it was yellow. And, of course, Wimbledon was the last big tournament to adopt that. Mm-hmm. Maybe 15 to 20 years later, they finally bowed to the pressure. But white is still in use on rare occasion.
Yeah. Terrific. And I'm going to go ahead and I'll read the bio for Matt Friedman, who will then talk for a moment about himself. Matt Friedman, who's known to many of you, I'm sure, an artist, writer, and former professional football living in Ridgewood, Queens. Recent performances include the Broken Time series with Tim Spelios at Studio 10 Gallery in Bushwick and at the Sculpture Center in Long Island City. In 2010, Friedman was intercepted and returned 74 yards for a touchdown by Tracy Porter to seal a recent Super Bowl competition and give the New Orleans Saints their only NFL championship. Do you want to tell us a little bit about
That's,
Matt?
That's basically it. That's my life. That was the moment. Unlike some of the other balls, as a football, I had a very specific job to do, and I did it. We can talk about that a little bit later. I'm a little nervous about being here as the only ball with a point or 2 points, and the only ball with a kind of a history and evolved sense of who I am. I sort of anticipate a certain amount of pushback against my status as a kind of at sort of the pinnacle of sport and culture. But be that as it may, I'm here to sort of be open to whatever may happen. There was an interesting side note to the game, the Super Bowl. It was in 2010. As to my knowledge, the only Super Bowl that was played twice at the same time. I don't think we have the video for both games. You may just see the sort of the known game, but there was at the same time the game was being played in Ridgewood, Queens, in a synagogue. Every play was actually repeated and improved by a group of collaborators. And so I was sort of simultaneously in two places, which gives me a kind of perspective on the game that most balls don't have. But
there's a very, if I understand correctly, there's a kind of Pierre Menard energy to the way in which
the idea was it was very easy for a bunch of highly trained, oversized athletes to play the Super Bowl, but for two middle-aged artists to actually enact the entire game, exactly the same game at the same time, was similar to Cervantes. You know, Quixote was okay, but you know, he was a 17th century conquistador writing about 17th century conquistadors, but for a 19th century Frenchman to write the same book was much more of an achievement. So that was the spirit of the game. But
can we actually take a look at your moment in the sun? Would that be appropriate? Should maybe tell
us. Well,
it was
not the sun. It was in the inside Super Bowl. It was, yeah. But it was
actually quite dark.
Roll the clip under the dome, if we could.
You'll see, I'm in the center.
There's help getting off the field. An apparent injury to his.
The interesting thing about being a footballer is that you switch sides very quickly.
From the New Orleans 31. Two receivers to the left, Garcon to the right. Manning in the shotgun puts Colley in motion. Looks in his direction. It's Jesse Bourne.
Watch carefully. Watch to see what happens to the moment of glory. He just scored a touchdown.
70 yards on the return.
So where are you now? Do you remember sort of what's happening now?
Yeah. I'm in a duffel bag.
You're in a duffel bag already.
It was very bad.
Right. Right.
But it's very empowering experience to have inspired that kind of enthusiasm, even for a moment.
Okay. Thank you, Matt. Many of you will know Simon Critchley, who, among other things, is Hans Jonas Professor at the New School for Social Research. He writes an awful lot. For those of us who also write, it's a source of some dis-ease. He has a very significant commitment to the Liverpool Football Club. When asked to submit a bio, it should be said that he did introduce an element of truculence to the evening's occasion by writing, he believes the ball is round, that a round football is the only football, which immediately started, and that football, and that Liverpool are the only football club. During this roundtable, Critchley, it's thought, may at moments heuristically inhabit the being of the ball involved in the notorious Wembley goal scored by Jeff Hurst in the 1966 World Cup final at Wembley. Now, many of you will recall that goal has been the source of, in effect, international consternation ever since. It was a ball that hit the crossbar, went straight down, hit the goal line, and the line judge was left to make an essentially impossible call as to whether that ball had crossed the goal line. It was ruled a goal, though has subsequently, by Germans in particular, always been alleged not to have been a goal. In that sense, I think we could say that this evening Simon Critchley is sort of on the fence in certain ways about a whole bunch of things, goal, not goal, ball, not ball, but we'll see what happens as perhaps we even run the
Yes,
clip,
have a look.
Should we?
Let's
should we
look.
Take a look?
Let's have a look.
Maybe we'll run the clip of
not everyone will know this.
The 1966 Wembley goal.
1966 World Cup final. This is extra time. The match finished 2-2. England were 2-1 up. Martin Peter scored the second goal. Jeff Hurst scored the first goal. And then some German, they scored goals. And then we were going to win the World Cup. Only 8 teams have won the World Cup in World Cup history. And it's a very hard thing to win. You know, the United States might win it, who knows. But it's unlikely. And no, but it's seriously unlikely anyone's going to win it. But the, and so we're, England's in red. And it was West Germany back then. And extra time. And then this happens.
His ball running himself back. Yes. No. No, the linesman says no. The linesman says no.
As you can see, I mean, football is a game with two halves, and the Germans always win, right? That's what people say, apart from on this occasion. This was clearly a goal. I was the ball, if you like. It clearly passed the line, and because of that, England won the World Cup for the one time in their history. If you ask a West German or a German about this, they will remember the fact there was a Swiss linesman, Swiss referee, and a Russian linesman, and we all know about Russian linesmen. Right? So obviously some money changed hands or whatever, some shenanigans. But the ball had a mind of its own. So the ball is not passive. The ball is not an object. The ball is not an inert substance, a bladder inside a piece of leather. The ball is alive. And the ball made a decision for that goal to be awarded to England and not to Germany. And because that won the World Cup, and that is a great ball.
This opens on to the very kind of question which with which I think we'd like to, you know, begin this evening. And it's a question to the panel, in a sense. It's an unusual opportunity to query ball being. But I think the question to the floor is simply, what is it like to be a ball? These are different kinds of thing, different balls here. So we're interested in a general way in what it's like to be a ball at the center of these confrontations, these sports, and we're interested specifically in your respective ball natures. And wherever possible, what you can tell us about what sport is from the ball's perspective, this would be rich too. So what is sport and what is sport like as a ball? Those are the questions to the panel.
Those were all the questions in one.
Should we start with sport? You guys have a take on sport from the ball's perspective.
No, nothing comes to mind, really.
Well, I don't know about this from the ball's perspective. I found this quite compelling. About 10 years ago, I took a trip to Libya for the World Championship chess match. They wanted a football there. And I got Gaddafi's little green book, where he writes incisively about a number of subjects, including sport. And I think this gets to something of the heart of what my position as a participant is. Says, sport is either private, like the prayer, which one performs alone in a closed room, or public, performed collectively in open spaces, like the prayer, which is practiced corporately in spaces of worship. The first type of sport concerns the individuals themselves, while the second type is of concern to all people. It must be practiced by all and should not be left to anyone else to practice on their behalf. It is unreasonable for crowds to enter places of worship just to view a person or a group of people praying without taking part. It is equally unreasonable for crowds to enter playgrounds and arenas to watch a player or of a team without participating themselves. What's interesting is that Gaddafi's own son bought himself a place on the Libyan national team and insisted that he be the only person whose name was announced by the public address system, and all the other players were mere numbers. He's now being tortured in a dungeon somewhere in Libya. But I think as a ball, I identify with that. I think there's been far too much emphasis on sort of the cultural aspect of sport as an American football, I think, with a long history of brutality behind us, that it is the game itself, the participation of the game, and the joy of being thrown through the air and being caressed by up to 22 players at a time that gives me the sort of satisfaction I want. But I don't intend to theorize that experience. I can go into the sort of experience itself, a subjective experience of being, say, in that particular play, switching from the fear of being incomplete into the joy of being intercepted and scoring a touchdown. But it's the moment of play itself which was most compelling to me. I didn't think about the future or the past, just the present.
Can I ask a quick follow-up? The rapid sort of change of fortunes in that match. Do you, as the ball, think of yourself as, say, in American football, on the side of the team who's snapped you? And is the moment of an interception, or as we call it, a change of possession, disorienting? Or do you attempt to maintain something like neutrality with respect to the sort of dialectical confrontation that is being staged?
I'm a complete pragmatist. So, yes, at the moment of the snap, I'm on offense. Uh-huh. And at the moment of interception, I'm on offense as well.
I
change as soon as possession changes, my interests change, so I cannot lose.
Amazing. Amazing. Do you think there's something distinctively American about that willingness to...
About the inability to lose?
That amphibiousness?
I mean, that sort of kind of sense of exceptionalism? I wouldn't dare to say it was exclusively American, but the fact that we, you know...
That play sports that no one else plays.
Right. I mean, we can get into this. I was interested, you know, the sport,
and
of course...
And then declare yourselves world champions.
Yeah. Well, we are, because nobody can beat us at a sport that only we play. It's kind of brilliant.
Well, I definitely think about
it. Simon, the British have a history of that as well.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, American football, as we were discussing before, is not an invention of the Americans alone. It's a descendant, an evolution, a crystallization, a perfection of ancient mob football and rugby football, and the name itself is a simplification of terms that came from the old country, and we can get into that, including this.
It might be worth taking a moment, just to go ahead and do a bit of that genealogy. I mean, it's reasonable to ask why it is that football is called football and football is called football when the games are so different. Is there common...
Well, football's played with feet. That's the
no, actually, that is another misunderstanding.
Hands, which is very strange.
Okay. It's not played with the feet. It's played on the feet. It's called football not because you kick the ball, it's because you're not riding a horse. And traditional sports like polo...
Which would be polo with the horse.
Would be polo with a horse, right, exactly. Right, right. So okay. Football was intended to say, we are men of the ground, of the earth. Whatever we do, whether we choose to kick or throw or caress the ball, it is our feet that do the actual... work of moving towards the ultimate goal.
Why isn't it called polo without horses rather than football? I don't see why.
Well, that would be an interesting thing to try to get on. Polo without horses, yeah. I think as an advertising man, I would.
This is the kind of the whole business about the Kiwi previously having been known as the giant hairy gooseberry and the decision to rebrand and the importance of that decision. I'm going to go ahead and just sort of push for that mob ball notion again. If I'm right, part of the reason that both these highly elaborated and needless to say, distinctive games share a moniker is that, in fact, they do have a common genealogical origin in these sort of village Saturnalia harvest feasts in which some inflated pig's bladder was sort of pushed hither and yon between contesting communities, and whether that was done with caressingly, as you've put it, Matt, or with the feet, in a sense, those diverged into rugger American football soccer. But am I right about that sort of warm village experience of sort of collective violence as a sort of shared point of origin for your respective?
Possibly. I mean, but what people always, I mean, and I just found this out earlier on, we were talking that, I mean, the name for football is association football. Association football. Football is about association.
Which gives us soccer, that sock.
Which gives us soccer.
Of association.
Right? So when we're thinking about sport is about sports, people, men, women, individuals playing sport. And I would wager this would be where the ball would, you know, we'd think from a ball-centric perspective. If you shift that around, football is about association. It's about a grid. It's about a matrix. It's about a group of people. You can't play football.
You mean soccer?
Soccer. You can't play soccer on your own. You've got to play soccer in a team. And when soccer is wonderful, it's where you've got three or four or four or five players playing together, occupying space. And the ball at that moment is not a passive thing. The ball is a kind of animate presence within that kind of field, which is not an individual field, it's not a subjective field, it's the field of sport where we associate. And that, so it really is a question of how you see it, Graham. How you see it. So we normally see sport from inside the head of the, you know, the sports hero and all of that, which is one way of looking at it. But looking at it from the ball's perspective, we see it as a field of motion and association and movement, and then that changes things.
So,
Harley,
please.
The one-on-one sport, I was going to draw a distinction between if what you're saying is the ball is passed around and is about group formation. Then in my sport, the situation is a kind of dialogic back and forth, and it's one of a lot of court games. And so then it's much more about measuring and placing the self. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you were kind of insinuating that other ways of approaching sport would be about individuals or people. But
yeah.
I think that even from the ball perspective, under a different set of rules, a different thing is happening. And so the self can be situated in space, or body can be situated in space through one set of rules, through kind of balls being measured against, very carefully against boundaries, or a group of people can kind of... group of kind of nodes can become a collective team through another set of rules. Although we're not supposed to talk about the rules and
the rules are essential, it seems to me.
What strikes me immediately would it be right to say that each of you, qua ball, has experienced your respective sport as, in a sense, an opportunity to choreograph the behavior of persons? Which is to say, whether the sport is a kind of association sport with a aggregation of individuals, like either of the footballs, or a fundamentally dyadic competition, say, like tennis, we sense ourselves moving in relation to the ball, but from the ball's perspective, there's a sense in which the ball fundamentally occasions quite elaborate movements in space-time of persons around the balls.
Can I address that? The manager of, or coach, as you say here, of Liverpool Football Club between 1959 and 1964 was Bill Shankly, who was a titanic, an heroic individual. And Shankly wants to build Liverpool into what he called a bastion of invincibility. And the model for that, he thought, was Napoleon. And he says, this is a quotation from Shankly, the sayings, the adages of Bill Shankly, he describes the form of football, association football, as socialism. Right? For him, the collective effort of football is socialism. It is the socialism in which I believe is not really politics, it's a way of living, it's humanity. I believe the only way to live and to be truly successful is by collective effort, with everyone working for each other, everyone helping each other, and everyone having a share of the rewards at the end of the day. So football, association football, soccer, I would contend, as a collective effort, is the living objective expression of socialism. And therefore, the other sports in their different forms are reactionary, retrograde, aristocratic, and therefore irrelevant.
Well, perhaps I should jump in as I'm, you're probably alluding to cricket when you say
aristocratic. An imperial sport.
An imperial sport. That's certainly true in many ways. It's associated maybe in many minds with what in England they call public school, but it's in fact what we would call private school in the US. And cricket is associated with the kind of homosocial rituals. They call it the smack of leather on willow. It's the sound of a cricket ball hitting a cricket bat, and yet in the mind that's more the kind of sadomasochistic hazing games that happen in these kind of boys-only schools. So that is, I mean, it's more than sport is a liminal space where culture leaks in. It's like a theater. And I really, the gentleman and the players is something that it's hard for me to talk about because it's all coming back, these Freudian traumas of the speed of this thing. But the cricket ball is the only ball of all of us that can kill someone. About 12 people die every few years thanks to the cricket ball. So it does add this element of kind of danger and frisson. And this is about transgression. So if you're in a team where some of you are rich schoolboys and some of you are, they were called the players. There were actually a distinction between amateur gentlemen who would play. They would travel in different cars to the game. They would be paid different scales. So there's a possibility of a utopian space because they are on the same team. So it's maybe closer to a Fourier type of socialism where there are hierarchies of...
Well, the seeds would be turned into lemonade. And the...
Right. It's yeah, it's not a fusional mode, but one where different classes can commingle and experience the frisson of transgression it's an alternative space which mirrors society but also suspends it. So that's what I mean by a liminal theater.
I'm surprised and impressed by how quickly we've gone to genuinely political questions. And I want to see if I can hold us for a moment from those, though I think that, needless to say, with the representative of a sport, the origins of which lie quite specifically in the spaces of the Ancien Régime court, I do think that there's no way we can finish the evening without tipping properly open fully political questions. But I must confess, Dominic, I'm enormously struck, if that's the right word, by your invocation of the possible fatality at issue in cricket. And I'd like to ask you directly, have you felt like a projectile? The course of the game?
I have, and it's a very intimate experience. It's almost a battalion kind of... I mean, that's why it was so shameful to be rolled harmlessly across the pitch, because there was no chance. I mean, he's wearing helmet, armor, and then this kind of impotent...
Dribble. A dribble.
A dribble.
It's yes, a dribble.
That's part of the humiliation, that I was forced to do that when I was very much looking forward to the projectile moment. But you have to understand that a cricket ball, it's not separate from... there's many hours of the bowler licking it, pulling at it, and especially rubbing the groin.
Rubbing the groin.
If you've watched cricket, you see that until the red becomes a part of the pants. And so there's the human DNA inside me when I'm being bowling. And it is a strange kind of being towards death, right. which contrasts strongly with the incredibly slow meditative pace of cricket, which happens over the real cricket, test cricket, and it's called test cricket because it's close to the testes where you rub the ball, is it can go 5 days, all day, and very often have no result. So it is an allegory for life in that sense, because it's slow, it's boring, and it yields no result. And there's a kind of Heideggerian confrontation with boredom. But at any moment, someone can suddenly be struck in the temple, or it's like, again, like life. It can be incredibly dull, but then something violent will happen, an event of some sort. And I feel very implicated in that as a ball, but not completely separate from the players, because I've infused their essence.
With the way Dominic has invoked both the kind of the erotical social dimensions of a sport, like a ball of leather and twine, and the way that he's emphasized these unsettling kind of intimacies and potentialities for violence, I confess that at this point I feel like I need a bit of a palate cleanser, and I want to come to Carlin Wing, who represents a ball made entirely of artificial materials, if I have that right, a contemporary tennis ball.
The contemporary tennis ball. Although the old ones were both guilty of killing several royal members of royal houses in Europe.
Prince of Wales Frederick died of a cricket ball.
Okay, well, we can compete. See whose list is longer.
Especially on my mind was just questions of standardization. And part of what was so striking seeing your opening images was the emphasis on something like a mechanical reproducibility of very specific effects in the ball. And I sense something like I don't mean to allegorize, but it's the odor of late capitalism's emphasis on bureaucratic modernization was so kind of strong in those images of techno-scientific evaluation, very specific performance envelopes. I strongly suspect that that's not characteristic of the kind of origin of your sport way, but that's so much where you found yourself, and maybe you would just talk with us a little bit about finding yourself at the nexus of what we have to think of as the administrative bureaucratic standardization of sport in late modernity.
Yeah. Okay, then. I'd be happy to.
Not to put words in.
what I'll say first is I'm not sure. I think you're right that particular scene, since I can only speak theoretically of playing, since I clearly never played, I was never hit anywhere. But the late modernity scene, you're not wrong, but it's really the 19th century where the standardization begins, when kind of Europeans rediscover rubber, a technology that was first figured out in the Americas here, but then kind of conveniently overlooked for a couple hundred years, and so that we could rediscover a process for curing it of its instability and rename it after a Roman god. So we develop vulcanized play, and we have this. This is not just my sport. This is, I think, all of the sports, actually, except maybe for the purely imperial sport. But all the rest of us represented here today are really dependent on this kind of modern material for standardizing bounce and for making a round object dependable, so that our bodies can organize around it. And that I would say is before we care so much about measuring. We're beginning to care. We're beginning to keep records. Tennis really gets going in the 1880s, 1890s, when an enormous rule book gets simplified down to kind of, I don't know, a tenth of its size, even less. There used to be a very elaborate handicapping system, but now it's very simple, right? There are love, 30, 40 game? 15, 30, 40 game. How many points is that? Five?
Well, it's a clock. Isn't the points of a clock?
It is the points of a clock. Although there's some debate about that, like most things. So we have this resettable organization structure that's been in place for a long time. And then we have this very simple court that gets simpler and simpler. The walls go away, the sloping rooftops go away, the nets go away. This was all the ancient form of tennis. And the modern court just becomes this rectangle with a net across it, and you measure the bounce. You measure whether it's in or out. And now this managerial moment that you're talking about is we've come to care so much about how regular the bounce is that there's a person whose entire job it is to test the surfaces of the U.S. Open courts. And it's top secret. This I wasn't allowed to go see. Me being me as opposed to me being the ball. That's very because there's quite a lot at stake. And this is where I guess I would fight. I would argue with Simon a bit and ask whether a ball that is in production, a ball for the World Cup, is I don't know how many hours of labor and how many elaborate wind tunnels and how much money is spent on that.
Huge
and how
amounts.
You can, even if the rules are still modeling socialism, I don't know how you can look at those stadiums and not talk about global
capitalism. Bit of a stretch, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bit of a stretch, yeah.
It's a bit of a, it's a fantasy.
Point taken.
It's hard under conditions of, positively pressured balls. The only exception, which on our current panel would be Dominic, if I'm not mistaken. But when we're thinking in the current moment about positively pressured ladder-based balls, it's difficult not to open the question of Inflategate and
all these intellectuals. No.
Maybe the easiest thing, rather than putting Matt on the hot seat, is to sort of ask a little bit about what the condition of being is of having one's innermost space be a vacuity to be built out of a void, pressured void, a void that wishes to leak out and does, in fact, of your bounce is...
The minute you open the can, the ball begins to die.
The ball begins to die.
I mean, which in a way proves that I'm very lucky because I got appropriated to other uses. It shows their kind of other lives.
I did live in Los Angeles for a year, which was a bit like that.
The positive internal pressure.
Of the void. Of the void. Of the emptiness.
I must say I'm struck by the kind of poignancy, Carlin, of your... never, in a sense, having experienced that exquisite moment of being at the center of the charivari, at the center of the occasion. I mean, Matt spoke so movingly of being caressed, of having the opportunity to let his loyalties relatively promiscuously shift with the winds in a given game.
You don't understand my occupation, clearly. It's not about loyalty, it's about commitment to a cause, which is fungible, I guess. But I didn't mean to interrupt. You were going to interrogate Carlin further.
Did you say the cause in question is the game rather than either of the competents?
Well, I'm in service to the game, which, incidentally, I just have to giggle a little bit when the tennis ball and the cricket ball bemoan the couple of fatalities per decade that they produce. Football has a history of killing hundreds of people.
But you yourself are really, you have impact.
I think you're overestimating. No, I'm responsible. I feel if I weren't so desired, all of this wouldn't happen. The fact that I don't actually create the trauma, the forced trauma that creates the disaster, does by no means mitigates my responsibility for the consequences. But it's a kind of a, I don't know if this would be more of a, this sort of Spiros Thanatos pleasure principle problem that we're dealing with, I can sort of embody both, I think. I mean, I also think, frankly, that, you know, I'm not a theoretician, I'm a pragmatist here, that this is, you know, the issue of Deflategate, which I think is often framed as issues of control or precision, is really, from my point of view, a kind of a trivial distinction. It was about, well, we don't know what it was about, but if the allegation that it was about trying to create a slightly greater opportunity for victory on the part of one team as opposed to another, I don't really see that as being a problem. I mean, it's only the sort of tradition of fair play and gentlemanliness, which goes back, I think, as you were saying earlier, to the sort of 19th century imperial colonial notion of behavior, which is, of course, intended to maintain a kind of hegemony of power relationships between the haves and the have-nots, that football and, frankly, the entire American experiment is opposed to in all respects. So the idea that this is not fair is really against the basic ethos that we all understand the game is about, which is to win.
It's very, I'd say, perspective. And that is, you're alluding to what some of you will recognize as the kind of traditional sort of social history of sport account of the rise of sportsmanship as a sort of feature of sports discourse, primarily British, primarily 19th century, and has about it a strong odor of a kind of effort to bring into conjunction previously disparate class interests. So this has been a standard line among sports historians for some time, that what we recognize as the rhetoric of sportsmanship is in fact a kind of zone carved open in 19th century capitalism for a new kind of conjunction of aristocratic, bourgeois, working class interests. And so it's striking to see Matt just disavow it altogether from the American perspective and say that victory as such ought to be kind of paramount in a exquisitely...
And I want to ask you a question, because I think where we draw the lines of what kinds of manipulation of what kinds of bodies fall into fair and unfair, I don't think we can just kind of hoist that off on the British as like they're the only ones who draw those lines. There's all kinds of manipulation of bodies, maybe more the players' bodies, that are allowed, and then all kinds that are, you know, get them called up on charges. So I'm curious how, I mean, you seem to be advocating in favor of game feel, which as someone that's felt covered, I can appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's no sport that doesn't have a level of gamesmanship. So I was speaking very particularly about that level of manipulation. I just thought it was interesting from my perspective. I mean, as a ball who potentially could have been slightly deflated for the advantage of a team. In fact, I haven't talked about this before. I was deflated. to give Peyton Manning a slightly better grip on the ball, and yet he still failed to execute properly. And that's, you know, I think you wrote about that, sort of the aleatoric. This is not entirely predictable. So the notion that somehow we are in control by creating these rules or these standards of performance, or it's sort of an illusion, and it basically gets to the sort of chaos versus order subtext of almost all sport, that somehow, as in a religious ritual, which it shares the same sort of the same sort of tradition of creating false barriers for natural behavior in order to achieve a goal which seems to be more valuable because of the difficulty you have in achieving it. It is ultimately just our responsibility to try to, as efficiently as possible, execute our given task. And in that case, I was just simply to be tossed and caught.
Can I pull us right to the question of surface for a moment and touch? Because I heard Carlin invoke the question of her felt superficies. And I confess that Matt has entirely reframed for me Inflategate by his emphasis on tactility, touch, and, as he's put it on several occasions now, caress or being held. And we do, of course, say that a football is cradled by a running back. And right. Am I right, then, that the slight reduction in your internal pressure, that is, in effect, to afford your human attendance a firmer grasp on your body? It really is about your being held in a different way.
More cuddling.
Yeah. There's a shift in something like your tactile presence. Is that something you feel you could talk about with us tonight for a moment, that shift?
Were you addressing me? Or
I am, because it just, now that we know that you were, in fact, slightly deflated for the purpose of being more firmly held,
yeah.
That's something I think all of us, in some sense,
aspire
to.
You're only the only one held with hands. So it's a different kind
Except for the... Well, on most occasions.
This is a different question.
It is the cricket equivalent of Deflategate is when you tamper with the ball, and a lot of us do get tampered with. And it can be an amazing feeling, because we're hand-stitched, as you can see, and pulling up the stitches is an illegal move, and yet it was very popular, especially amongst, well, the captain of Pakistan, Afridi, was captured on camera biting the ball like an apple and pulling up the stitches with his teeth.
It's ball abuse, isn't it? Really?
Sorry?
It's ball abuse.
Well, we could be complicit too, because it can help us move in more interesting ways. And so it can be enabling. But... yeah, when he was caught, he said, "I was sniffing the ball, trying to see how what it was feeling." And but there's an entropy involved, unlike the other. I mean, everything's subject to entropy, but the way a cricket ball wears out can be good for different types of bowling. So later on, as the ball, they're for 80 overs each. And then they replace it with a new ball, which has this glamour. Everyone's always talking about the new ball because it's going to bring new vitality to the game. But and yet the old one, even though it's all worn out and scuffed and lined and wrinkled, can do more interesting kind of angles when it hits the pitch. And it is. I still maintain that there's a theater, an important symbolic theater to cricket, because there are these understudy balls that... they just wait, hoping they will come on, but usually they don't. But it's the obligation of the umpires to have balls, the equivalent wear and tear of every half an hour, say. So if they lose a ball, you just quickly bring one in that's at the same level of wear. And so...
That's so cute.
Is that to say that the entire, in a sense... life history of a given cricket ball must be at any time represented in a box that can be brought onto the cricket pitch and presented so that the umpire can choose a ball to replace a lost ball that is at the same sort of life stage or life phase as the lost ball, if I got that right?
Yeah, it's a profound assumption that you can replace one monad with another just by virtue of their kind of temporality. There's sort of material wear.
Striking.
As if the game will go on the same, because it's been through the same amount of temporal experience, but it hasn't taken those wickets, it hasn't been sniffed by Afridi, you know. So it's the kind of plight of all understudies, even, you know, Shakespeare in the Park or whoever. It's a strange waiting, never quite having your moment in the spotlight.
So I'm curious what you think, like, what we think that kind of entropy or the value, where the value in that lies. Because I think in my sport, like, what that room is all about, that room that I live in, and what the 90,000 balls that are used to play a single U.S. Open tournament, because it's a new ball basically on every hit, is all about pretending away any kind of entropy. It's a kind of much more computational, like, let's pretend
perfection every
or the same every time. You know, so batch testing and
How many balls did you say in like given?
90,000 are used.
For one US Open.
For one US Open tournament.
90,000.
That's astounding.
Whereas in a 5-day game of cricket, you might use 7 balls.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. This leads to a question about symmetry. Your invocation of having been kind of nibbled, and the question of wear and tear on a ball. I note that all the balls here on the panel today are along at least one plane of axes. Symmetrical, so there's at least one plane in which there's uniform symmetry. You were not a bit of an outlier.
I'm a prolate spheroid.
Yeah, but still, does anybody want to say? I mean, does anybody want to say anything about the experience of feeling oneself out of round? Is that distension, aneurysm, certain kinds of asymmetries? These are experiences that you're probably closer to than anybody else.
You mean deformation?
Deformation, that's it.
Well, it's a common occurrence to lose the leather skin and then have to be replaced.
This is a flaying, a kind of Marcian experience. Full.
And the umpires do, in fact, have a little, I think they keep it in their pocket, ball-shaped, slightly larger, where if there is concern that the ball has been out of this perfect sphere, they will put if they can't push it through.
They test its round.
Then the understudy comes in. Yeah.
I want to make sure we get a chance to go to the floor for some questions before we wrap. I have one last question I'd like to open to the floor before we move a mic around the room, and it's really perhaps a little vasty and quasi philosophical for our purposes tonight. But it's not impossible to conceive sport as ineluctably agonistic, right? So these are occasions of something like sublated conflict of different sorts, which means there are opponents.
War is the sport is the continuation of war by other means.
There's that right. Whole line, and again, there's
some stuff used by the British Army as a substitute for sex in their rules.
Well, they both work.
Sex has its own kind of.
I'm just saying what the British Army tried to do with it.
Sort of agonistic energy, it should be said. But so what I was going is toward, if you like, a sort of a softball Hegelianism here, where there's two teams who are clearly in an antagonistic relationship, but strikingly, the ball in each of these sports constitutes a tertium quid. The ball is the third thing. Now, I don't want to suggest in any way that the ball constitutes a synthetic aufgehoben type situation. That doesn't seem right to me. But I wondered if any of you had an account of what it's like to be that third thing in a contestation. And if that feels right to you at all, or if that just feels totally off base. Can I throw that out there?
I guess I would say, since Matthew referenced it earlier, the way I tend to think about this is most sports are aleatoric in the sense they're structures of planned chance. And what balls do is they introduce another kind of uncertainty. And so from the position of being that uncertainty that the game is then organized around, everyone orients around you. All the players orient their bodies around your movement. And what compels them to do that is, as Matthew was talking about, is your uncertainty, your unpredictability, and kind of them, whatever practice they've accumulated and whatever, however many kind of games they've watched or played, whatever body muscle memory they have going on, the ball is the sun, and you revolve. To quote Sarah, to claim that for myself.
I do want to push back a little bit against this sort of familiar notion of sport as sublimated war. As DeLillo said, we don't need sport. We have war. War is war, and sport is sport. And I think one thing that I note as a participant is that these games are essentially exhibitions. We think of them as contests. We think of them as battles where there's a winner and a loser, but essentially they're demonstrations of skill or chance that create a kind of a consequence that has very real ramifications, but ultimately is meaningless in a kind of a larger sense. And it's only what we project onto those exhibitions that gives them meaning. So I think in a sense we're all participating equally, the players on both sides in the ball, as, you know, as the most unpredictable ball here. I certainly have had the experience of being sort of in a state of flux where I'm being pursued by both teams. I have to say, Graham, that it is as a ball that's put into play as opposed to the ball that is kicked. There, in American football, there is actually a distinction between that. That both teams have their own balls that they prepare for offensive play, and there's another set of balls that are actually punished with the foot. Everything else that a ball goes through in a football game, ironically enough, is quite gentle. We're taken care of, as you say. We're cradled. We're recovered. You know, mm-hmm. We're completed. Mm-hmm. And it's quite satisfying emotionally, I have to say, to be desired like that by
you
so many.
Sometimes. Yeah,
and converted.
Yeah. Striking.
Not to play word games, but I have to say it's quite a powerful experience.
A couple things I want to say, which would be that what Carlin said is right. It's chance, it's aleatory. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that is the case objectively. But what's characteristic of the sport that I represent, and I think of all sports, is fate. This is fate. And this is why sport isn't sport, it's drama. Tragedy, comedy, tragicomedy, farce, whatever it is, but it's drama. So sport isn't really sport, and we know that. Mm-hmm. Sport is about something playing out, which is, there's this chance, of course, but there is this sense in which one is living, if you're an England fan, a recurring nightmare. A recurring nightmare where, apart from on this one occasion, where the ball did this weird thing, we lose, right? It's about defeat. So that sense of fate, I think, is really important. And I suspect there was a kind of, Matt was voicing a kind of brutal pragmatism in his defense of his ball, and there was a whisper of kind of Ivy League reductive Marxism in what Graham was saying. And I want to say this evening, ladies and gentlemen, that for me, sport is about virtue, and there's no conflict between agonism and virtue. Right? Sport is a terrain where there is agonism, where you want to win, and it's horrible to lose, but the thing is knitted together by a kind of deep set. And for me, it's perhaps the last place where virtue actually exists as a lived set of practices. And this is what's, with the cricket example, this is what's so offensive. If you're not from this context, it's just... But this is bad form. It's just not cricket. A line has been crossed. And a moral line has been crossed, which shows that in sport, what's revealed is this dimension of fate. And it also reveals the kind of the moral dimension, the moral cosmos that we live in, which only perhaps exists in sport. In all other areas of life, it's evaporated. But at least in football and other things, it carries on. I think that's, you can't reduce that to class interests or pragmatism. All of that is playing out, but there's something more. And that's what offends us when something like that underarm.
It's what it relates, I think, to what Clifford Geertz called deep play.
Yeah.
And as part of my research into the colonial vectors of cricket, I did my field work as a ball in the Trobriand Islands, which is famous for repurposing cricket as brought by the missionaries for their own purposes. And their own types of virtue, and their and it was interesting because these Methodists, I think they were ministers. They called it the mission game. Introduced cricket deliberately to stop the warring of the tribes in this part of New Guinea, and they quickly changed the rules so that it was a syncretic combination of the old warfare and this new introduced game, some of the things that changed, as a ball, it felt very different to be in this game because the agonism is there. They're doing chants and war songs and everything, but it wasn't about winning because the home team is the always wins.
Is it possible we have a clip of that we could get to eventually?
No,
of the Trobriand cricket situation?
Unfortunately.
Okay, all right, I was just checking. You'll have to evoke it for us.
But it is, whoever shows up plays. So there's no limit of people. There's usually 11 on a team, but if 50 people
mob cricket.
Up, mob cricket. But yes, there's nothing at stake in terms of winning or losing, and yet you go through the game itself still, and it is chanting, and they, I don't know whether this, the English would drew the line when they started introducing magic into the play, and that did feel very differently as a ball. When someone would cast a spell.
Right, I can imagine. Shall we take one or two questions from the floor? Is there a mic, Sina? Great. Okay, so we do have a mic. Maybe Joe Maloudis up in the front here. Oh, a question, of course. Please.
Is it working? Yeah.
Yes.
Hi. So I had a question for Carlin. I was just thinking about how there's so much of this conversation is about the play and the game, and as a ball who has never been in play, you can't participate as much. Which is a shame, and I'm wondering about things from your perspective because you actually seem kind of happy with your life. and you describe yourself as deformed but also fortunate, and I was just thinking about you as this kind of like queer ball who doesn't go into play but is doing something else, and I wonder about a world structured around you and like what... how you think about your life.
Oh, thank you for that question. I mean, I do, because I do feel a little out of place. They've had glorious and traumatic experiences, but they're, you know, they have all the passion and the play and the ritual, and I can't really speak to that, or I can only speak to that theoretically. What would I say? I think there's something devastating about the fact that the minute the can opens, the ball begins to die. The idea that you'd only be hit once and then you're no good anymore, because the whole thing, all of this design, all of these hours of labor and all of this technological knowledge and like an entire global supply chain, you've passed through 3 factories, you've been on who knows how many ships just to get to wherever you've landed, and then, you know, you bounce a couple times and if you're lucky, you're into the practice bin, and then, you know, maybe you have a lively life. So I guess maybe my life is more like that of the retreated monk, where I get to kind of think and consider about the conditions of the game and the conditions of bounce, which I'm seeing tested repeatedly around me, and I can only maybe there's something powerful in the imagination and that of it, rather than having to go through that kind of disappointment. There's this other path that I got to take where I got punctured and still proved useful. And got to learn things that, you know, most tennis balls never get to learn. And got to see and be hold bodily shapes that were other. So, thank you.
Joe. Yeah.
So my question to the balls, given that we've been talking about these political issues, is what does it feel like to have some English put in you or on you? You know, if you have a little English put on you.
Yeah. What's that mean?
How is it that the term English came to mean, in American English, spin or torque or disorienting kind of twist?
That's a good question. I know that it's in the first electronic games, like Magnavox Odyssey, they had a questionnaire, and so it's a kind of electronic game of tennis, And in the questionnaire for that game, they were trying to figure out what players wanted the translation of tennis and ping pong to look like into electronic space. And they were asking, do you want spin on the ball? Do you want, you know, how many players do you want to have play? And the initial machine not only let you put spin on the ball so you could make the ball go kind of up and down on the screen, but you could keep putting spin on the ball after you crossed the halfway point. So you could just kind of try to evade your opponent all the way through. There was no reason why you had to stop controlling the point. So
there must be hypocrisy. It must be linked to hypocrisy, right? English hypocrisy.
Body English.
Treachery and
yeah, like the French view of the English is you can't be trusted.
But I think the question I suspect is how is it like to not to be sort of manipulated in such a way that some sort of sense of trueness is not achieved, that your trajectory is deformed. And I think, to me, it's not really as much a question of physics as metaphysics. And a number of balls, I think, have had this experience. There's an anecdote that quarterback John Brody spoke about years ago when he was trying to complete a pass to a wide receiver, I think named Gene Washington, for the San Francisco 49ers. And he said there are certain moments when you are so sure of what you are going to achieve that the ball will actually change its course in order to allow that to happen. He said, I knew so clearly that I was going to make this pass completion to Washington that the ball actually moved over the hand of the defender, and on tape you can see this anomalous jump. And it was just a matter of will of the players. I do want to add just parenthetically that we're talking about sport at the highest level of play, where these issues of will and achievement sort of predispose or at least kind of assume that certain kinds of actions are sort of maximized, the maximized potential of both sides. I know personally, after I was retired from sport, I played for a while on pickup games, and the sort of level of that we haven't talked about neuroses and the inability of an athlete to actually fulfill their promise is really, I think, almost as fascinating, perhaps more so, than the professional who has sort of created a kind of almost robotic-like efficiency in their behavior. And the removal of their will, of their ego from the sport, or at least the direction of their ego towards a maximization of effort is not that far from, I guess, the loss of selfness or awareness of selfness and the idea of flow that is achieved in any kind of great creative act. So it's not only a moral question, I think it's an act, it's a question of sort of creativity itself.
I just want to ask, do we actually agree that spin is a name for something bad? Because Simon's saying that this is British hypocrisy. But it's also, just because my ancestors were involved, were used by scientists to kind of describe spin. Back in the 16th century, you know, as they're trying to figure out planetary motion and everything, we had the honor of being the object that was actually you could hold in your hand and you could sort this out, and so you could think about planets and you could think about atoms and wonder what they were up to. So I just want to, spin doesn't have to be quite so derogatory.
Right.
I think it's more speaks to that control of a certain level.
It's also, I mean, you're making me think of the virtual realm, which sport is involved with in many different ways, and how, you know, it's been said that planes are the crystallization of their pathways. And so all that technology and mapping that happens in a computer before you were born, you're just one moment in this sort of virtual map, and the actual tennis ball itself is, you know, an actualization of something that preceded it. And so when you have those replays of the tennis ball just coming in and out or not, it's that's trying to trace what happened. Whereas in cricket, I think we're the only sport where there's so much technology and software to prophesize where the ball would have gone. Because if it hits the batsman's legs and would have hit the wickets, you can get out. It's called leg before wicket. But the umpire has to make that judgment whether it would have hit the sticks. And nowadays, normally it was just up to the umpire and you had to agree or disagree. Now you can appeal, and they have this technology which is so sure that with the angle and everything that it will either hit or miss.
Eagle eye, what's it called?
Yeah.
Hawkeye.
And yet, as we've seen, like, virtuality is not, it's different from possibility. Like, you can't, can you anticipate exactly what a body in space will do?
Can I have one thing, which is what was said before, which is, you know, the balls have agency, as, you know, tonight has made manifestly clear. And, you know, there's this fantastic movie called Zidane, made by Philippe Parrainot and Douglas Gordon. And there's this commentary by Zidane, Zinedine Zidane, one of the greatest football players ever, a living god. And he talks about this one moment when he was aware, he before the ball came to him, he saw exactly what was going to happen. He saw exactly what was going to happen before the ball came to him, and he knew exactly what was going to happen. He foresaw it. And it was foresawn, as it were, within
the ball. It was the same as after the fact.
Yeah, and it became true. And there's that kind of, and that's also this dimension of, this isn't just chance. There's something more than that in the movement of a ball. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of agency there which is kind of not random, not just random.
We have time for maybe one more question from the floor, if there's someone who'd like to throw their hat in the ring.
Yes, I guess it's apropos maybe perhaps of this conversation, which is, if you think of any of these balls and you flatten them, and it has to do with the pattern of these balls when you project them. And so therefore the kind of, I don't know, you take a baseball and it's an hourglass, an interlocking hourglass, or a football. I mean, any of those balls are, if you flatten them, none of these balls in sports are singular skins. They are made out of composite pieces. They're patterns. So I don't know.
Wonderful. A wonderful question. The question of,
well, I'm
the
talking
scene.
About flattening a three-dimensional figure in all of these. If you take any of these sports balls and you flatten them, you have very distinct kind of figures, and therefore we're talking about a kind of construction of any of these balls, and therefore it leads to a whole host of things that you guys have addressed, but nevertheless.
It's a question that articulates very beautifully with the question about spin, because, of course, it's seams that make spin happen. It's a distinctive quality of baseballs that they have the seams they do. It's the reason a wiffle ball behaves as it does, that it has these kinds of slightly asymmetrical characteristics. It's the reason that balls are nibbled on and rubbed to produce kinds of qualities in relation to their seams, to produce effects. So it is absolutely true that we have a ball with a single seam and two hemispheres, a ball like a baseball with a pair of hourglasses, a ball that's built out of gores, exactly like a globe, meaning sections that are like a mandorla, like an almond shape. And then a ball, as it happens, the 64 ball was pieced out of a set of rectangles, although the ways in which World Cup balls have been pieced out of different forms has become part of the
much
kind
more
of...
more elaborate.
Yeah, and almost like a kind of branding and marketing routine to continuously reshape how that's done. Maybe to bring us to a close, a word or two on seams. On seams and the condition of being composed and possessing seams, as each of these balls do.
Well, I would like to speak to this idea of the panel, and because I think what's interesting about that comment is it, for me at least, brings me back memories, and maybe for Simon as well, of our true history. I mean, these are modern balls, and we talked a lot about the technology around contemporary games, but the association football, the rugby football, share a common ancestor, which is the pig bladder. And the pig bladder is itself. It's irreducible. It's an object. It's not entirely round. In fact, perhaps the shape of the modern ball, modern football, came from the sort of plum-like form of the bladder. And so at its rawest form, the ball is it can be deflated, but it can never change its natural shape, just as the early sports that used the pig bladder had no limitations on the number of players or the techniques that the players used to achieve their goal. There was very little skill. It was all a matter of pushing and striving. And I think there's something quite beautiful about that. This mm-hmm. you know, the modern American football, perhaps alone of these, well, I guess the cricket ball has the seam as well, but the seam on the side of the ball is both an anachronism and the key to the way play is achieved. It's an aerodynamic form. I can fly 90 yards through the air without deviation from a path because of the control that the seam gives the skilled practitioner. And yet, as you say, anything can create a kind of a crisis and a radically deformed flight, which translates into disaster for one side and triumph for the other. So I think the seam is sort of is an interesting metaphor for sort of the investment we have in contemporary sport for particular controls of outcomes, but historically is perhaps not as interesting.
I am enormously struck by that final image. It's also true that many of our modern sport balls have deponent seams. Basketballs used to have sewn seams, and they don't any longer. And the American football is the kind of interesting and odd exception in the sense that it has laces, which are, of course, no longer technically necessary for the production of a ball of that form, but represent a kind of self-conscious anachronism that retains some modest functionality, but also more than a small portion of kind of nostalgia for the era of mob ball that Matt invoked. We've opened up the ball along a couple of seams this evening. Please join me in thanking our stalwart panelists. And I think there's probably beer in the back for a little bit, and feel free to hang about for a while and mingle. So thanks very much.